I trolled off the kayak for salmon. I'm surprised you didn't starve to death. Remember, I've seen your fishing abilities, Katie joked. Laughter was a near constant around the table, with Jonathan having an amusing tale to tell about everyone there. As the early evening dinner wore to a close and the air temperature began to drop, the men moved to the fire pit, while the women moved inside. Thorne packed a pipe, knowing his friend would like nothing more than to roll a fresh tobacco cigarette, yet with Caroline so close he wouldn't dare. When the old war horses started discussing their plan for the following day, Reese and Rafe stepped a few feet away. Rafe not wanting the scent of tobacco to negatively impact the next day's hunt.
Good luck tomorrow, Reese said.
Thanks, buddy. If you're around, I may need help packing the meat out.
Well then, I changed my mind. I hope you don't get him, Reese chuckled.
I'm planning to take Katie into town in the morning, but we'll zip back if you need me.
Reese, his friend began, what were you looking at during dinner?
What do you mean?
You know what I mean. At times you were here, but you weren't really here.
Reese had forgotten how well his blood brother knew him.
Nothing. Well, not nothing. Just a feeling. Something's not right.
Something's always not right, brother,
Rafe offered, scanning the distant tree line.
Remember what your dad used to tell us.
Trust your instincts, Reese recalled.
After everything you've been through, don't let the past ruin your today, Rafe said wisely, nodding toward the main room where Katie sat with the rest of the family.
Remember what your dad used to tell us? Reese responded in kind, nodding toward the weathered old Celis scout.
He's always full of what he thinks is good advice.
Reese's eyes narrowed, and his head turned back toward the shadows.
He said it's not paranoia if they're really hunting you.
Part 2. The Stalk. Civilized men are more discourteous than savages because they know they can be impolite without having their skulls split as a general thing. Robert E. Howard, The Tower of the Elephant. Chapter 34. St. Petersburg, Russia. The strain was beginning to wear on Gray, who had scarcely left his desk in days. The plan was contingent upon Reese leaving the ranch, yet he hadn't left the property in 72 hours. Changing the operation at this stage was a recipe for disaster and would require breaking his self-imposed ban on active electronic communications. Remembering what the duo had done to his mentor and handler with an RPG-32, Gray was beginning to worry. Svetlana made her nightly visit before her departure, tea in hand. This time, however, she carried a cup for herself, which was a first. She set a cup down in front of Gray, who sat at his desk, staring intently at both computer screens before him. He looked up at her with exhausted eyes and snapped his laptop shut. There was something different about her tonight.
I brought you some tea, Oliver.
Thank you, I see you have some for yourself. May I offer you a touch? Gray lifted the vodka bottle from his drawer.
That would be wonderful, Oliver.
He poured a finger of the clear liquid into her cup and filled his own to the brim, sipping tentatively to test the temperature.
Why do you work so hard? What is it that can't wait until tomorrow?
Something very important. Something that will make them fear me.
Anyone who knows how smart you are should fear you.
The Americans think that they are so powerful that they fear no one.
Ah, you will show them, Oliver.
She took a long pull from her own cup and set it down, rising from the chair and walking behind the small man. Her scent filled his nostrils as she began to massage his shoulders with her powerful hands, releasing the tension that had built up over the preceding days. Her hands worked their way up the back of his neck and onto his head, where her fingers made tiny circles on his temples. He let his head fall back with a sigh and closed his eyes. Svetlana leaned forward, pushing her ample bosom into contact with his head, and began rubbing his chest. She smiled as she saw the front of his trousers rise. Gray opened his eyes when she swiveled the desk chair so that he was facing her,
his body tensing as she ran her hand to his groin.
Such a big, strong boy. No, Svetlana, I can't. I...
Shh, Svetlana will take care of everything. You be a good boy.
She pulled open her blouse, exposing her breasts, which Gray immediately began to grope and kiss. She pulled her skirt up and sat on his lap, breathing heavily in his ear as she ground herself into him. He gasped audibly and his body quivered and lurched forward, nearly knocking Svetlana from the chair.
I'm sorry. I...
He pushed her from his lap, a dark stain visible on the leg of his tailored slacks. Unable to look at her, Gray stood uncomfortably for a moment before hurrying from the room. Svetlana did not hesitate. She pulled a USB drive from the pocket of her skirt and quickly inserted it into the port on his laptop. She walked to the office door and stole a look down the hallway. A small LED on the drive flashed red as the device downloaded the contents of the computer's hard drive. Svetlana walked out to her own desk and shuffled around as she kept an eye toward the restrooms. Picking up her phone, she sent a text message before dropping it back into her purse. When she heard footsteps in the hallway, she returned to Gray's office and palmed the USB drive. She was straightening his chair when he returned, his eyes averted. She wrapped him in a warm hug, holding his face to her chest.
Good night, my sweet Oliver.
She kissed the side of his head and walked from his office. That evening, a young man rang the doorbell at her apartment. When she answered, he handed her a bag of carryout food. Inside a wad of paper money, Svetlana passed him the USB drive. Within an hour, the contents of the drive were being exploited by a trusted team of technicians from Directorate 1 of the SVR, the Office of Russian Intelligence that specialized in digital forensics and cyber exploitation. Chapter 35. SVR Headquarters, Moscow. By the time Alexander Zharkov reached his desk at 8 o'clock a.m., the report from St. Petersburg was already in his inbox. His attention was diverted by a mild crisis in Damascus that morning, so he didn't get a chance to open the document until the afternoon. The cover sheet summarized the raw intelligence and made reference to both the source of the information as well as some of the more relevant documents recovered from the subject's hard drive. Svetlana had performed beautifully, just as he'd known she would. The Russian intelligence services were the best in the world when it came to manipulating subjects using sex, and the psychological analysis of Oliver Gray had been spot on. Alexander had pulled in all information on Gray going back to the original paper files when he was first spotted, assessed, and developed by the Soviet-era GRU before his recruitment by the late Vasily Andreyev. It was always amusing to Alexander when he saw state documents marked with stars, hammers, and scythes, the pseudo-religious emblems of communism. Upon their re-examination of Gray's records, the SVR's psychoanalytical team had come up with a secondary diagnosis, one that went deeper than the obvious father issues. As a result of his father's absence and eventual abandonment, his mother had overcompensated and inadvertently created an unhealthy relationship with her son. He was unable to connect with women his own age or younger because deep down, he still hungered for a mother. Svetlana had been successful in earning Gray's trust and bringing his repressed gerontophilia to the surface. Alexander had placed Svetlana, one of his most experienced assets, into his father's business more than a decade ago, and she had consistently provided him with accurate, timely, and relevant updates on the activities of his father and brothers ever since. He double-clicked on a PowerPoint file titled Montana Op Ord and began scanning the pages. He quickly realized that the operation in question had already been put into motion. He scrolled to the profile on the targets. He recognized the name of Lieutenant Commander James Reese, U.S. Navy, retired, immediately. thanks to the widespread media coverage of his attack on a ring of conspirators responsible for the deaths of his family and SEALs under his command. The SVR had actually tried to locate Reese after his disappearance in an attempt to recruit him and offer him the chance to defect, but had been unsuccessful in tracking him down. Alexander also knew that Reese was suspected in the death of former Russian intelligence official Vasily Andrenov, though nothing had been proven. It was obvious from the intelligence package that his father's new asset had organized a Bratva hit team to kill James Reese, either in retaliation for the Andrenov assassination or before Reese could mount an offensive of his own against Gray. The second target was more of a mystery. Rafe Hastings, also a retired SEAL officer, was a resident of western Montana. The African-born Hastings owned an outfitting business and had made a name for himself as a builder of fine custom hunting rifles. Hastings was apparently married to the daughter of a billionaire oil and gas man who'd previously served in the U.S. Congress. Could it be him? Alexander, ever the hunter, was an avid reader of outdoor magazines published around the globe. He had become mildly obsessed with a columnist who wrote occasionally under the pseudonym of S. Rainsford, a nod to the protagonist of Richard Connell's 1924 short story, The Most Dangerous Game. The columns were the author's first-hand accounts of his solo Montana backcountry hunts, told in brilliant detail. Unlike most of the glorified advertising that passed as outdoor journalism these days, whoever Rainsford was, he was a hunter. Alexander pulled up the background check via Russian intelligence channels he'd requested a few months back. They had failed to identify an S. Rainsford, but had compiled a list of 24 possibles. Rifle maker and hunting outfitter Rafe Hastings was on that list. Alexander leaned back in his chair and tilted his head toward the ceiling.
S. Rainsford. Now he would be a formidable adversary. Adding his friend James Reese to the draw would be the hunt of a lifetime.
Alexander had once managed to attract a famous hunter from the States to hunt brown bear with him on the Kamchatka Peninsula. Despite the way he was portrayed in his articles and television series, the man was actually hopeless without a guide. When Alexander turned the tables and made him the prey, he wept and begged before becoming desperately lost. His ineptitude and lack of spirit took almost all of the pleasure out of the hunt. Alexander had seen better woodsmanship from Moscow prostitutes than he had from the overweight American.
Rainsford and Lieutenant Commander Reese would be fighters. Finally, a challenge.
Alexander made his decision. He pulled an aging paper Rolodex from his desk drawer and searched for a number that he hadn't dialed in ages. Chapter 36. Coomber Ranch, Flathead Valley, Montana. The sun would rise at 6:55 a.m. Rafe had been awake since 4 a.m. He turned off his alarm so as not to disturb his pregnant wife and slipped out of bed. He sipped black coffee as he dressed in a light wool shirt and pants, pulled on a knit stocking cap, and laced his buffalo hide Courtney boots. Everything he wore was designed for maximum mobility and stealth. With the prospect of running into a grizzly bear, a real one, Rafe slipped his inherited 1911 handgun into the leather holster behind his right hip. He remembered his dad's joke about 45 caliber pistols and giant predators. "Why do you file off the front sight of your 1911 when going into bear country?" his father had asked. "So it doesn't hurt as much when the grizzly shoves it up your ass." Rafe had never found it very funny. It was only a 10-minute drive from his home. He made the trip with just his parking lights on so as not to spook game or ruin his night vision. He donned his pack, picked up his recurve bow and quiver, and stood silently in the darkness to acclimate himself to the sounds of the pre-dawn morning and confirmed the speed and direction of the light breeze. The morning was cool, but there was no frost. Satisfied, he began the hike toward his glassing spot. He wanted to be in position to observe the buck well before the first rays of light illuminated the valley. With practiced efficiency, he climbed the steep grade, the simple tire soles of his boots legendary for quiet stalking. At 40, Rafe was in the best shape of his life, and given the field in which he'd spent the early part of adulthood, that was saying something. The sky was just starting to lighten to the east, the nighttime display of stars washed away by the first rays of sunlight. He set himself up for a long morning of glassing, arranging his tripod and spotting scope before pulling an apple from his pack. He took a bite as he swung the powerful scope toward the buck's lair, its coated German lenses gathering every bit of ambient light. The buck should have been out feeding on the mountainside at this point in the relative safety of the darkness, but there was no sign of him. He pulled up his binoculars and began to scan, trading magnification for the wider field of view. Nothing. The slight change in temperature would not be enough to move the animal from his summer range, so that wasn't it. It wouldn't be the first time that he'd watched an animal for weeks only for it to disappear the moment that the hunting season opened. Prey species seemed to have a sixth sense when it came to the hunt. Rafe thought about his conversation with Reese the previous evening and took an extra moment to survey the high ground behind him before turning his attention back to the scope. As the sky turned from gray to pink, it became increasingly obvious that the buck had left his hide. Something had spooked him. Wolves, maybe? It was conceivable. Poacher? Not out of the realm of possibility. Rafe needed to adapt. The wind was still light but steady, and the thermals wouldn't be much of a factor this early in the day. It was time to move. The son of Rhodesia packed his spotting scope and picked up his bow before setting out quietly down the draw. Rafe's tracking mentor had been a master. Melusi was a member of the Matabele tribe, a Bantu offshoot of the powerful Zulus. The Matabele people were defeated in battle by the Dutch Afrikaners and were effectively banished to what is now Zimbabwe. Like all great African trackers, Melusi spent his childhood tending the herd, responsible for protecting the family's cattle, sheep, and goats from neighboring tribes or predatory animals. With no fences to contain their herds, Melusi and his peers would spend their days tracking each wandering animal by its spoor. It was a tremendous responsibility to place upon a child, but Melusi had a nearly supernatural gift for reading the ground and quickly took to his job. Melusi had taught Rafe to read sign from a young age, in much the same way he was taught by his own elders. One of Melusi's favorite tricks was to take Rafe to a salt lick, where animals of various species would gather to consume the valuable mineral. Melusi would squat in silence, smoking a hand-rolled cigarette, while Rafe pointed out each individual animal's tracks. He would nod as Rafe called out each name in English, Shona, and Undibili. By age 6, Rafe could tell a waterbuck track from that of a kudu, and before he was 8, he could tell the age of a track to within a few hours. He was able to read animal spoor in the wilderness the way an urbanite used street signs. Rafe's tracking skills had brought more than a few Taliban and Iraqi insurgents to an untimely end and had earned him the respect of the hunting guides with whom he worked. The buck's sign was everywhere thanks to the many weeks he'd spent sleeping, eating, urinating, and defecating in the immediate area. Rafe made increasingly widening circles, searching for a track that led away from the site. He found it on the uphill side of the bedding spot, near the rock slide that made up the ridgeline. He saw the deep impressions of the buck's hooves as he hopped in the manner unique to an alarmed mule deer. Something had spooked him. Rafe hadn't seen any wolf or grizzly sign in the area, nor had he heard any wolves howling recently. No one other than family or friends had permission to be on the property, so He shouldn't have been startled by another hunter.